Hello world, this is Stephen Francis, and you're listening to the Humble and Honest Podcast. Before I begin this episode, I want to make an important reminder regarding this show. This podcast is humble and honest conversations with Christian leaders on cultural matters, but this show is not an echo chamber. It aims to talk with people who may not believe all the same things that I do. Today's episode is a reflection of that truth. I am joined with Dan Koch. Dan Koch hosts the You Have Permission podcast and is a doctoral student in counseling psychology at Northwest University. Previously, he hosted the Depolarize and Reconstruct podcast and played guitar in the band Sherwood. He now lives with his wife Joffrey and son Soren in Seattle, Washington. Dan Koch has a very different theological and biblical belief system than myself, but is someone who I frequently learn from and hope you do too from this conversation. Today we talk about what makes someone a Christian, along with purity culture and end times popularity. Hear for yourself the conversation, and let me warn you, some of you will be challenged, maybe even offended, but it will for sure be humble and honest. Check it out now, my conversation with Dan Koch. Dan Koch, what an honor to have you on the show today.
I appreciate it, man. Thank you.
Sir, you have been definitely influential in my perspective of theology. At the same time, though, I want to talk with you first and foremost about your story. For all of our listeners that don't know who you are, share with us, who is Dan Koch and how did he become the influential person he is today?
So my story, I was raised non-denominational in California. So if people kind of know the evangelical world, you could put a couple things together already from that, right? Like on the one hand, it's definitely in the middle of the evangelical zeitgeist. But on the other hand, it's not the Midwest or the South. So it's a little chiller. You know, my dad was a therapist, still is. I had a kind of a, what you might say, a moderate evangelical upbringing. So I recognize all the tropes and all the language. I had a True Love Waits ring, which I think we'll get to later. You know, I went to youth conferences and all of that, but I was not raised fundamentalist. It was not like a Southern Baptist kind of like, you know, there's so much sort of Christian humidity in the air, everything, you know, I didn't have that, which I'm very grateful for. I think it gave me a fairly balanced view, and I'm able to appreciate a lot of things about evangelicalism that some of my friends can't appreciate because they were raised in so much stricter, so much more barometric pressure pushing down on them. I'm using all weather analogies this morning for some reason. Anyway, so I was in a band for 10 years called Sherwood, is an emo band, toured the world. And then I became friends with a band called Emery, and those guys started the Bad Christian podcast, I don't know, six or seven years ago. And that's how I got my start podcasting, is I was a guest on their show a number of times just because I was friends with them and they were interested in some of the same stuff I was interested in. That led me to start my own podcasts. This is my third one that I'm doing now. It's called You Have Permission. Previously, I did some called Depolarize, which was more politics focused, and Reconstruct, which was also theology, but I did it with a buddy of mine who co-hosted with me. And now I'm doing You Have Permission, which is basically it's a show about taking Christianity and the modern world very seriously. For me personally, that leads me to a kind of a progressive Christianity for the most part. But it's not like it's not a show where I'm trying to evangelize progressivism or anything like that. I'm just like trying to talk to people who know what they're talking about and also talk to people who have a respect for the lived faith experience of Christians. And I'm also a student. I'm in my second year of a psychology PhD program right now.
Talk to me about the show. What has been some of the more interesting conversations that you've had on the show so far, especially for someone that may be hearing about it for the first time?
Yeah, I think that there are sort of two categories of episode, if I could zoom way out. There are the episodes that tend to be more helpful for other people at various stages along their journey, oftentimes people who are a little younger than me. I'm 37. And those are things around atonement theories or gay affirmation or not, or you know, hell, salvation, inerrancy, these kind of like the big questions that anybody finds themselves asking when they go down some of these roads that are fairly well worn at this point. And then the other category of episodes are like the ones that where I am like super engaged, and I think of them as sort of like frontier horizon topics for kind of where I'm at as a person right now. And sometimes those get less plays usually because, you know, I get it. They're a little bit more niche, but those questions around like the integration of Christianity and psychology, for instance, like had a really great one about disgust psychology, this module we have in our minds that makes us think things are gross, that we are get revolted by them, right? So gore, open wounds, rotting food, rotting flesh, these things just automatically turn us off. And that module can be activated by other sort of less gross things. And sometimes this is what we find in racism. Sometimes this is what we find in homophobia, right? So for instance, it might be true that God does not want anybody to live a homosexual life. It is also true that for people who are raised in communities where homosexuality is looked down upon, that they're disgusted by gay people. And I would think that even if you think that gay people should be celibate or something, you probably should work on the disgust thing. Like, they're not lower. They're not subhuman because they're gay, right? So it's good to be aware of that kind of thing. So those are the kind of episodes that get me really excited as a training psychologist. And then the other ones are the ones that get most other people excited, like hot topics, you know, the stuff that people are really wrestling through in their own lives.
I think that's very interesting. I actually heard that discussed episode. What are the specific things that you yourself would not hold to as the conservative Christian view? What also makes you still feel or define yourself as a Christian?
Well, I want to invert those two parts. So I think it's worth asking ourselves what we think counts as a Christian. And I think a lot of times what we find is that our church, our pastor, even our own beliefs will say a certain thing. For instance, we might say something like, a Christian is someone who has accepted Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior to forgive their sins and make them, you know, make union with God possible, right? Both now and in the afterlife. And yet we come across someone who says, I'm a Christian. I don't believe in hell. And then we go, wait, if you don't believe in hell, are you really a Christian? Well, if we would refer back to our own rule, if that person has accepted Christ as their Lord and Savior, then yeah, they're a Christian and they have a difference of opinion about hell. What explains that? I think what explains that is that other things that are not central to our understanding of what counts as a Christian end up kind of bleeding into our working definition that we is unquestioned. That's just kind of going in the background. And that has a lot to do with the people we're surrounded with, our family members, our church members, our denomination, like you being a pastor. This is not a knock on you. This is true of everybody in every profession, but what your denomination or whatever body you have above you that like could, you know, that basically controls the living that you earn, that stuff's back there. You're going to be more resistant to change some of those, to change some of those beliefs. There's a reason that churches don't leave their denominations at the drop of a hat, right? So that's not bad. That's just human. That's just how we are, right? I think that we let a lot of things in that aren't part of the definition. So for me, when I say I'm a Christian, what I mean by that is I follow Christ. Like my fundamental orientation to the world is colored by the story of Jesus of Nazareth. Those are my values. When I imagine my deathbed and what I will be grateful for and what I will regret, it is on the grid of what Jesus taught. If I'm laying there thinking I didn't love my enemies, I didn't love my neighbor as myself, then I will have failed as a Christian. And I think that what happened in Christ is the clearest picture of what God is like, how God relates to the world, that through Jesus we see what God is like. These are the things that make me a Christian. The first part of your question is, what are the controversial or, you know, liberal things I believe? Well, I don't believe that the Bible is inerrant. I think that there's just really not good evidence for that view. I don't believe that there is a hell, or if there's hell, it's empty. And I am fully affirming of LGBTQ people from a theological lens. I don't think that any of the stuff that they're deciding or doing specifically along that axis is, you know, sinful or keeps them out of the kingdom or anything like that. Now, of course, every single person can still sin sexually and does probably sin sexually. If you count thought life, everybody does. So I'm not saying that some people get a pass morally. I'm just saying that the fact of their being gay is not disqualifying in and of itself. I'm fine with women preaching and being pastors. I'm an egalitarian in that sense. I don't know. Stuff like that, I guess.
Do you use the Bible then when people do try to refute, like, wait, but the Bible says this about homosexuality, and what about this passage about hell? Do you approach people with the biblical rebuttal for that?
Yeah, I think that it's a balance. So as you're kind of getting at this, that oftentimes when people will respond with a verse, they are also assuming inerrancy of the text. Is that, have you talked about that term on this show? Do I need to define that?
Define it.
So inerrancy, as it's generally meant these days, is like nothing that the Bible declares is wrong of anything that historically, theologically, sequentially, you know, whatever, that like anything that the Bible says is true. All of it is true. I don't think that that's true. I don't think we even need that for salvation. I don't think we need that to be a Christian. Most Christians alive today are in denominations that do not affirm inerrancy. Catholic Church, Anglican, Episcopal, Orthodox. Right there, you got about 70% of worldwide Christians, and none of those churches have an inerrancy doctrine. Now, some people will say, well, those people aren't Christians. Again, I would point them back to Jesus and say, I sure think that they are. Insofar as they are trying to love, you know, that they're living within the Christian tradition and trying to love God and neighbor, you know, through that tradition, they're definitely Christians. So that is an assumption often. So I will try and tease out that assumption if I think that that's going on. And I'll say, well, let's talk about what we think the Bible is. But yeah, of course, I'll still use the Bible. And it's still important to understand context for scripture. So, you know, this is kind of 101, hell, Bible hell 101. But Jesus actually doesn't say hell. He says Gehenna. And Gehenna and Sheol, right? So Sheol is the kind of like shadowy land of the dead from the Jewish scriptures, which is not like Dante's Inferno. It's a lot more like Odyssey and the Iliad, the underworld, you know, in Greek mythology. It's like you're kind of there, you're sort of yourself, you kind of have some access to this life. Abraham's bosom is sort of, there's like a parable with Lazarus. Anyway, then Gehenna was an actual trash heap outside the city of Jerusalem. It was a physical place. Now, I think that Jesus is using it metaphorically, of course, and I do think that Jesus is talking about judgment of some kind. But in Gehenna, nothing burns forever. It burns continually. It burns over time, but it doesn't literally never stop. It's a physical place. The stuff there will eventually burn up unless you put more stuff in, which is what you do in a trash heap. You know, you keep adding stuff to it. But the old stuff, you know, it does go. It burns up like the chaff, to use another. So I'm not a biblical scholar here, but I do think that there are ways of understanding these passages that make them, you know, coherent with other views or other interpretations or whatever. And yeah, what the big thing that we often do is we assume that the interpretation that we have heard is the main one and that all other interpretations are the weird ones. But of course, it only takes 10 seconds to realize, If I had been born into a different denomination, then I would think that that was the main interpretation and that this other one was the weird one that I believe. And so we just have to have a little bit of humility about that.
Thank you so much for sharing that. You know, the thing that your show talks about, your show talks about a landscape of different subjects, including what you just covered. But two of the ones that actually brought me to your show was your conversations on purity culture and also sexual shame. Can't help but feel like, you know what? This is stuff that actually the church really needs to confront head on, especially to those people that are still living with the scars of the things that have happened there. So can you talk to me about some of those episodes, some of that content, and why you believe this is worth addressing for yourself?
Yeah, maybe we could start with something that I heard over and over again as a teenager, which was, the Bible is clear. Don't have sex before marriage. That's a lie. I mean, that's either ignorant or deceptive, probably ignorant in most cases. I think that the people who said that to me had been told over and over again that the Bible was clear about that. And so they repeated that. But the Bible is not clear about that. You have to infer all these things, connect different verses to each other, make certain assumptions about what God's doing in the new covenant versus the old covenant. I mean, it's actually a mess if you look at the text, especially the Old Testament. And so it's like it's this kind of overreach, and it's this kind of what my generation grew up with. It was a bunch of people assuming they all agreed about sex in the Bible and then taking fairly drastic steps and creating something called purity culture, which is basically, you know, it's a little hard to define, but it's the entire industry and set of curricula and teachings around abstinence up until marriage. And basically it's also a kind of lens through which to see sex before marriage, as that ends up kind of vaulting it up to the top sin. Right. And actually, the conversation that we just had about disgust, this, I think that this plays a role in why purity culture was able to succeed in getting people to think that sex is the big thing, because sex is a lot closer to our disgust module than other sins are. For instance, let me give you an example. You find out that one of the elders at your church, his company engaged in some light tax fraud. I mean, you're like, okay, I mean, I guess that's bad. I mean, don't people do that? I mean, but no, but he lied to the government. He knowingly did it. He stole money that was the government's and enriched himself with it. No matter how many ways you do it, I'm just never going to, like, I'm not going to gag about that, right? I'm not going to get disgusted by that. And yet, that's a very, very clear violation of a Christian ethical principle. Now, if you say to me, these guys, man, they put it in each other's butts. Now, all of a sudden, I'm like, that's gross. So I try to think of like the least gross way I could say that on the podcast, least explicit. But like, that is, you know, there's a part of that that's gross, like, unless you're into that. And then you're like, I don't understand why that would be gross. But if you're not, like, bodily part stuff is just has a higher sort of, I don't know, like volume for us in terms of like our moral sense. Right. OK, so trigger warning here. This is also gross, but I'm being clinical here. Imagine someone said, you know, hey, we're just bodies. It doesn't matter. It's just molecules. So why not just have your grandma in her open casket at her funeral be buck naked, you know, just spread eagle? No, we would say that's a violation of sort of the sanctity of grandma's body. Like, we wouldn't do that. That would be wrong. Most of us would feel a deep aversion to that. So it can be good. And I think there's something very good about, like, not, you know, like showing respect to elders and not having them walk around naked. Like, we don't want to get rid of it entirely, But we should recognize that that's just like a very, very powerful force. And so that force is at work around sexual sin in a way that it's not at work around other kinds of sin. There's a long preamble to talking about purity culture. I apologize. But so I think because of that, and then because of fear on parents' behalf of their kids getting STDs, getting AIDS, getting pregnant, whatever, you just have this like tremendous amount of feeling that gave tremendous power and license to this purity culture system or whatever, infrastructure, right? All these different curricula and companies and conferences. But turns out to just tell everybody to deny their sexuality until their wedding night doesn't really work. And especially what we find in case studies of people who went through this is that not in every case, but in a lot of cases, girls were treated quite differently than boys. And so you have an extra layer of sexism, whereas oftentimes boys were treated kind of like, hey, you stumbled, you know, get back on the horse. Girls are often treated like, oh, you've actually soiled yourself. And the purity culture, not metaphors, object lessons that they would often use are like, you know, you put an Oreo, you say, who wants to eat this Oreo? Then everybody spits on the Oreo. And then you say, who wants to eat it now? That's your body after you've had sex with people before. You know, no one's going to want to have you because you have been defiled, right? And then you think about like, is that really how Jesus would have thought of the woman at the well? That with she'd had seven husbands or whatever, and the man she's living with now was not her husband. You really think Jesus thought, you're a spoiled Oreo, Samaritan woman? I don't think so. I think that this ended up landing us far from Christ and closer to just like a kind of, I don't know, a standard conservative sexual ethic or something like that. Not a biblical one. And it's led to a lot of shame, a lot of people in therapy, a lot of people leaving the church altogether because of the trauma inflicted by this thinking. Yeah. Anything else?
Hey, world. I hope you're enjoying this conversation so far. I'll let you know of a couple ways that you can support the show. If you haven't already, you can subscribe, share, and leave a review for the podcast so more people get the chance to know about it. Also, you could be a contributor through Patreon. For as low as $1 a month, you can help support this show and continue these conversations you are hearing today. As a thank you, all Patreon contributors will be receiving all the episodes of Season 2 in their entirety. I don't know if you knew this, but you are listening to a short clip of what happened. There were so many deep moments and great laughs that didn't make the cut for this episode. But if you are a Patreon contributor, you will get to hear this and all the episodes of Season 2 in full. Check it out. I'll put a link in the description for this episode. But right now, let's get back into this conversation with Dan Koch. Well, let me just speak on that. I resonate with what you're talking about because I grew up in this culture as well. And instead of at my church, we had a time where it was a guest speaker that showed up and he didn't do an Oreo. He did like a bottle of water, but he like spit and put backwash into it. But it was the same concept, to which, again, that's not how Jesus feels about anybody. But also the idea that men, it was just kind of like, guys, we know it's hard. Just, you know, bounce your eyes and do things like that. And then the pressure on the women to be like, you don't lose yourself. And there was a sense of property about women that I just hated. And also the idea of like, if we're really called to be men, there needs to be a lot more, or at least how I say it, there needs to be an equal level of accountability, as opposed to boys will be boys. And if a girl does anything that would be considered sinful in a sexual way, she is less of who she ever could be.
I mean, I think you can explain some of that by the fact that in conservative Christian worlds, women are not writing the curriculum. Women are not really involved in the decision-making process. You might have women lead the girls group on sex that morning or something, but they didn't come up with the rubric that they're going to teach. And so you have this kind of lopsided thing where oh, lo and behold, it ends up being kind of sexist, and it was written only by guys, and it doesn't, you know, and it's blaming the women instead of blaming the men for their ravenous sexual appetite. It's like a little, it's almost like funny how convenient that is. And I think that that's probably a part of the explanation for why it ends up being kind of lopsided and sexist.
I could definitely agree with that. You know, what are other areas, in your opinion, that the church isn't addressing properly? You know, I feel like there's been a shift now with purity culture. I think a lot of pastors have started to realize, our Christian leaders have started to realize the damage of what was being taught before. But I definitely believe that there's other areas as well that we need to be a little bit more forward thinking in. What's your opinion on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. Things like purity culture, things like a super strong emphasis on the end times. These are kind of things that like your generation and my generation and maybe Gen X are not that into, and they're not really repeating those mistakes, which I think is a really good thing in most sectors of the church, maybe other than sort of fundamentalist corners or something like that. So that's good. But, you know, I think there's actually, so the big one today, I think, in the States is the marriage of church and politics. You know, especially in the white church, there is really sort of the, you know, it's so funny. I think this is the best way to go into it. Being a progressive Christian, the number one argument that I hear and that people like me hear is, you guys are caving to culture. So we know the truth of the Bible, and God's truth is not always a happy truth for the world and the larger society, and we're willing to stand up for it, and you guys are uncomfortable with that, so you're caving in. And I actually think that what we see there is the church caving to culture. I think there's a particular kind of white conservative culture in America that is led by outlets like Fox News, that is very fear-based, that involves a really heavy persecution complex, and that culture has actually superseded people's Christian identity for a big chunk, maybe a majority of white evangelicals. The reason I don't say necessarily a majority is that I don't want to say that voting for Trump is equal to this. You could vote and hold your nose. You could be passionate about abortion or something like that, or really care about Supreme Court justices. There's reasons you could have voted for him. But it's more the continued support of Trump. In my mind, what that shows is that someone's white, largely white, conservative culture is more central to them than their Christian claims. Now, there are probably some people listening right now who are like, if they made it this far, which, way to go, now they're done. And that's fine. And I would just say, well, you know, maybe I'm wrong, but just what's the harm in asking yourself that question and really seeing if that might be true? But that's kind of how I see it. And so, sure, purity culture is doing better. There are some interesting questions there about the way forward, which I don't think is clear at all. It's still a very complex question. We're doing better on end time stuff. We're doing better about like scaring kids through hell and that kind of a thing. I think all that stuff is better, but this is a big one still. And I think that it will be the single largest cause of people leaving the church is the marriage of faith and politics. Now, in the black church, you just don't find this. The numbers are staggering differences between the white and black church in terms of white Protestants and black Protestants, right? In terms of political affiliation. I say that, you know, what I just described, your church might not have any of that issue. And so maybe I didn't get at the concerns that you were hoping for. But when I look at America, that's problem number one.
You know, I want to actually go back because you've said a couple times about end times theology, and I've loved your episodes about that because I was also one of those kids that watched the Left Behind movies and was just scared. That was scarier than anything I could ever see with Freddy Krueger or Jason or anything. The idea of being left behind and being in the tribulation. Talk to me about those episodes. Fill us in on what your subject matter is in those specific episodes.
Yeah, so there's a four-part series called End Times Anxiety in which I interviewed younger people, like 25 to 45, about their experience with that and its relation to mental health problems that they've had as adults. And then there is a follow-up two-part series called End Times Popularity that was me interviewing baby boomers about why this was so popular in the first place. So they're the generation that really made it popular, starting with the Jesus movement in the 70s and culminating in Left Behind in the 90s and 2000s. So I'm interested in all of those aspects. This is basically those episodes were kind of pre-research for my own dissertation in my doctoral program, which is something to do with spiritual trauma and eschatology, end times teaching. And the reason that I am interested in that is that's my story. I have panic disorder currently in remission. This just means I'm not like a worry wart. That's what we call generalized anxiety, like constantly worrying about things. I don't have that. I'm actually fairly oblivious to the things of the world and my body, and I'm up in the clouds all the time. I get like intense occasional panic attacks about things. And end times teaching and speculation and claims of the Antichrist or whatever are the number one trigger numerically in my personal history. And so that's what led me to be interested in that. And it turns out I'm not alone. Turns out a lot of people have stories. I put a little call out on Facebook in two places, my own page and the Bad Christian Podcast page a year and a few months ago. And I had to shut down responses in 45 minutes. I said, I've got enough people, guys. So unless you have a really good story, thank you, but I don't need it. And I got, 30 people in 45 minutes or something that were like, yep, that's me. I have mental health issues associated with that teaching. And so perhaps it's actually quite a large, I don't know, I don't have any way of quantifying how many people, but as you know, we can quantify certain things. Left Behind series sold over 100 million books, plus the movies. The Left Behind Nicolas Cage movie, I think made like $60 million. It's a pretty big film. The Left Behind movies were not quite out yet. And so we watched A Thief in the Night and A Distant Thunder. Yeah, these 70s movies, right? And then later they could just show them the Kirk Cameron Left Behind film that probably, even though, frankly, it's not any better, even though it came 25 years later. So, this stuff is so bonkers. I start laughing about it at some point.
It really is. But I think the point you're trying to make is that we can't quantify the level of damage it has on people, but we can definitely quantify the level of popularity this type of theology is. And, I can't help but think about how what you're saying is very eye-opening in the sense that there are people with mental health issues because of end times theology. So what would you say? Again, there's people that haven't heard these episodes, and I'd encourage anybody, if they're bold, to check it out, check out Dan's podcast. But would you say that the church should maybe not talk about these things? Should consider the mental health element when talking about it?
That's a great question. I think that there are topics and issues where there are issues for which there are inescapable difficulties, okay? And that doesn't mean that we shouldn't talk about them. So, for instance, talking about sin, there are people whose background is such that, like, all sin talk is associated with really toxic experiences, abusive leaders, maybe abusive parents. And, like, that's not going to help them, that they need a new word for it. But should we get rid of the word sin altogether? I don't think so. It's a very valuable, important concept in Christian theology. So there are some issues like that where the cost-benefit analysis is complicated. And so it's good to just be kind of careful. Maybe you give a one-sentence disclaimer, before you talk about sin. Like, hey, I know some of you have had these stories. I'm going to try and be very clear. I'm not trying to repeat that. Whatever. That's a simple workaround, maybe. In something like end times theology, it's actually much easier because it's wrong. Like, it's, I don't know that for sure, of course, but it's very bad theology. It's very bad textual criticism. And literally no one has ever been right in their major predictions. The one prediction that anybody got was John Darby, who basically came up with this style of theology 150 years ago. He got it right that Israel would become a nation. Now, it happened 100 years later, but it eventually happened. But he was very geopolitically savvy guy. He had a number of other predictions, smaller ones about, like, you know, Scotland and Ireland leaving the UK. And like he was right. Like he had that kind of savvy. But also the people who followed him were part of the influencing. They spent money and influence on the Zionist movement that eventually led to Israel becoming a nation. So there's even a little bit of a causal relationship there. Other than that, everybody has been wrong about every single other person. This person might be the Antichrist. This will be the Battle of Armageddon. This, the UN will lead to X. None of that stuff has ever come true. So when you combine a complete failure of claims with a very unlikely set of assumptions about the Bible that lead us to these prophecy maps and all this kind of stuff, they're based on so much conjecture and opinion. And then they never agree with each other and they're always wrong. So in that sense, it's like, yeah, just don't do it. Just let's just cut that out completely, because we're always wrong and it hurts people. If we want to teach on Revelation, I think you just have to do it with like a giant asterisk that says this book is written in a literary genre that is extinct now. So none of us grew up reading apocalyptic Judaism. We don't know that. It's like a form of poetry that from aliens, you know. It's like we can, now there are people who do understand it, sort of, who have other examples, and they can read, you know, non-biblical examples of this genre of literature, and they can make some guesses. But we just don't, like, we should just have a lot of humility around the prophecy stuff. But that would require people to be really thoughtful.
You just reminded me of how in seminary, getting my master's degree, how I had to take a class on the book of Revelation. And I ended that class with more questions than answers, because there's just a lot of things that you can try to make a bold claim about. But the way that literature is written, and like you said, it's no longer in existence, it's so difficult. It's almost like if someone made, like, you ever seen like a crazy A24 film that just left you like, what was that about? Maybe it's supposed to be more about the message that are like what we're supposed to feel than what we're supposed to take away. But point is, I feel like Revelation was the A24 of the Bible. You know what I mean? It was just kind of like...
I love that.
We're just kind of like, what did we just read? How does this end? And it's kind of like, it maybe we're supposed to take away that God wins in the end.
I think so. I think that's the biggest thing. I'm not super familiar with like the academic research around Revelation, but my understanding is that a very popular way among scholars to read it is to situate it as it's a letter to persecuted Christians in a very powerful empire about the fact that in the end, that empire doesn't win, God's love wins. God wins over empire to persecuted minority. And then we here in America, especially as white Protestants, the wealthiest people in the world, read it as, oh, this is a story about how us, the most comfortable people who have ever lived, will be spared all the suffering of the tribulation because our nation supports Israel. Like, what? That is like, Revelation is for slaves being lynched. It is not for fat, wealthy white people who have never had a hard day of work in our life. Of course, most of us have had hard days of work, myself included, even though I am white and fat. But you know what I'm saying? So we're just totally, but that's because we don't understand the genre, right? So that is an example where a certain kind of view of the text, namely, this is written to me in English, I can just read it, really has a bad effect. That does not work for the book of Revelation. You just can't do it that way. If you do, you're going to end up with all these problems that we are now talking about.
Dan, you've given me so much to think about. And
good thing we recorded it.
I know, right?
Well, it's so funny. Next week, it's in a week or two, I'm having a conversation with an atheist who asked me to be on his YouTube channel. So that's like the other end of the spectrum. And he's just like, why are you a Christian? You know? So it's so funny. I get the same question, like, why are you a Christian, from the my left and from my right? Like, why are you still a Christian if you're a liberal? And then these atheists are like, why would you ever be a Christian? And so it's funny to be in that middle space. I guess I would like to wrap up what I'm saying with this. So if you recall in the film A Thief in the Night, or it might have been A Distant Thunder, there's a scene right after the rapture where there's a guy on talk radio, and the talk radio host is like, here to explain what went on is this liberal pastor, because the liberal pastor knew about the end times predictions, but didn't believe them. And so he wasn't raptured. That is a really good example of how I was taught to think about liberal Christians growing up, is that in some sense, liberal Christians are worse than non-Christians because they're like traitors to the cause, as opposed to like, oh, they're just Muslim. Well, maybe we can make them Christians, right? And I've had to really unlearn that. In fact, some of the most loving and like Christ-like people I've met, especially older teachers, are liberal theologians, and they really love God, and they really are doing their best with the questions in front of them, and they go to church regularly, and they, you know, and they raise their children in the faith. So that's something that I have had to unlearn, is that, oh, liberal Christians aren't real Christians. As I said at the beginning, what's a Christian? Pick your definition and stick to it. If you think a Christian is a Baptist, then change that and say they're not Baptists. That doesn't mean they're not Christians, right? So we're all doing our best. We live in a very complicated world. You know, there's an explosion of information, and it's disorienting, and we're all disoriented, and it's okay to be disoriented. This is the world that we grew up in. And yeah, wow, that was my way of trying to end on a positive note.
Well, I definitely think you stuck that landing. Dan Koch, thank you so much for this conversation.
Yeah, man. Pleasure to be here.
And there you have it. My conversation with Dan Koch. Dan, thank you so much for this conversation and sharing a perspective on things that I personally don't come across often. If you guys enjoyed this episode too, I highly recommend his podcast, You Have Permission. I'll put a link in the description for this episode. I also want to thank all of you guys for listening, and hope you will join me again on the next episode of the Humble and Honest Podcast.